actually. I had only the vaguest idea of what went on behind bedroom doors, but I had been too proud to admit my ignorance to Louisa. I suppose this is a hazard of working with the royal family, I said, giving him a commiserating nod. They think they are above the laws that govern normal people. I had the Prince of Wales proposition me. Well, that's a lot better than that blasted Villy bloke, isn't it? He replied, grinning. At least he's not perverted, and he's British. And he's also a fat old man with a beard, I replied. I can't imagine anything more revolting than being touched by him. Besides, I intend to choose my own mate when the time comes. I suppose I'm out of the running for that position. He gave me that cheeky grin again. Nelson's made it quite clear that we're to stay away from you. Nelson's a really nice boy, I replied, but I'm not ready to be anything more than a friend to him. Blimey, Helen, from what he says, he's already planning who's going to play the wedding march on the big day. Oh no, not really, my heart skipped a beat. I really haven't encouraged him, Jimmy, I promise you. He said you let him kiss you. That's true, I admitted. But it was under the mistletoe on Christmas Eve. I could hardly say no, could I? Then I think you better set him straight when you get home, he replied. And in the meantime, do you fancy going out with me? I hear that carnival is coming up. Carnival? Like a fair, you mean? Oh, much more than that. They celebrate before Lent. Like Pancake Day, you mean? From what I've been told, it's an absolute riot. Thousands of people in the streets, all dancing and drinking, wearing costumes and masks, and there are big floats and bands unlike anything you've ever seen before. I'd like to see it, since we're here, I said. And I'd appreciate being chaperoned by a sturdy lad like you, but I don't want you to get any ideas. We're going as friends. Bob's your uncle, he said, reverting to a Cockney expression. And so we agreed we were going to carnival together. Then the Queen's secretary let it be known that Her Majesty would also like to experience carnival in Nice. This meant we were all to have the evening off, so I'd be going in a group with other members of the household, which made me feel much better. Jimmy was a nice enough boy, but younger than I, and frankly, not what I had in mind for a potential suitor. I found myself wondering if Giles Waverley might be attending carnival. A few days before the big event, the weather turned especially mild, and the Queen announced she wished to have a picnic in the park which adjoined the hotel. It was a fascinating place. I'd only had a chance to explore it briefly, but it contained a Roman amphitheatre, rows of old olive trees, a children's carousel, and on the far side an ancient monastery from which we heard bells tolling at regular intervals. Since I was officially the pastry cook, the preparation for the picnic fell upon me. Tiny finger sandwiches, biscuits and cakes, grapes and tangerines, and, of course, my scones with jam and cream. Mr. Phelps and Jimmy came to help me as I made shortbreads, ginger biscuits from Germany that were a favourite of the Queen, macaroons and lemon curd tarts. At the last minute, we prepared cucumber, egg and cress and smoked salmon sandwiches, wrapping them immediately into damp linen napkins to keep them moist. Flasks of tea were prepared. Everything was packed into hampers and loaded onto carts. Mr. Phelps and I went ahead to help set up a serving table in the shade of a big eucalyptus tree. For a casual event, it certainly took a lot of planning. Footmen spread rugs and a chair for the Queen to sit, since it would be deemed too undignified to see her lowered to the ground. The Queen's Highland pipers were assigned to keep curious onlookers at bay. However, naturally robust men in kilts had the opposite effect and drew even more bystanders. At 3 o'clock, the first of the household members walked from the hotel and stood in groups, chatting and awaiting the arrival of the royal party before they could sit. At 3:30, the first of the carriages arrived, containing Princess Sophie, Count Willie, Princess Beatrice and her children. This was followed by a dashing open carriage pulled by two white horses, in which rode Her Majesty, Princess Helena, and, to our horror, the Indian Munshi. The latter jumped down, offered his hand to Princess Helena, who rejected it, and then together they assisted the Queen to the grass. The Queen was all smiles as she sat on her appointed chair, and a nod was given to us to begin serving tea. We poured the cups, and footmen handed them around. The various sandwiches were passed. The Queen, I noticed, ate heartily and rather too quickly. I wondered she didn't suffer from indigestion. Next came the scones. She took a bite or two, then looked over in my direction.
"Ah, my little cook who makes the delicious scones," she said and beckoned me to come forward.
I approached nervously and dropped a curtsy.
"I didn't realise you were part of our small gathering here," she said. "But I should have guessed, because I suspect your light touch is behind some of the cakes we have enjoyed."
"Thank you, Mum," I replied.
"We must make sure we have some of the scones for my son," she said. "He has promised to join us today, although, as usual, he is not punctual."
I tried to keep my face composed. I gave another curtsy and backed away. I was wondering how quickly I could return to the hotel, but I hadn't even reached my serving station when the Queen exclaimed,
"Ah, here he comes now, the laggard!"
And a smart carriage came into view, a small affair, just big enough for two, rather like the carriage I had shared with Giles. I was relieved to see it was not the automobile and Ronnie Barton was not in evidence. Thankful for small mercies, I supposed. The Prince had been driving himself. He hopped down with surprising agility for one of his bulk, handing the reins to a servant.
"Ah, here you are, Mama," he called in his big voice, striding towards her.
"You're late, as usual," she said.
"It's only a picnic. I didn't think there was an appointed hour for such things," he said, giving her a kiss on the cheek. "Besides, I was going to bring the automobile, but it does not like steep hills, so I had to revert to the carriage."
"You're lucky that we have saved you some food," she said, "including the scones that you liked so much."
The Prince looked across in my direction.
"Ah, my little scone girl," he said, and I saw his eyes light up for an instant.
I gave a demure curtsy.
"I am absolutely famished," he said.
"I require sustenance in the form of scones immediately." And he beckoned me to come forward. I had no alternative. I put scones, jam, and cream onto a tray.
"Bring him tea at the same time," I said to Mr. Phelps.
"Safety in numbers." We came forward together and I held the tray while the Prince helped himself. He was the model of decorum with his mother so close beside him. He merely nodded and I retreated, my hands shaking a little. I was safe. I had worried for nothing. I was the little scone girl, nothing more. At least I now knew one thing. The Prince had been surprised to see me. Ronnie Barton had not spilled the beans that I was here in Nice with the Queen. That was one thing to be thankful for. I realised that I now did have power over him. It felt good. The Queen had had enough to eat, which meant that nobody else in her party could have any more. The moment she finished any meal, that meal was deemed to be over, much to the annoyance of her guests, I suspected. We packed up and the remnants were loaded onto a cart waiting at some distance. The royal party began to amuse themselves with various outdoor activities. Rackets and shuttlecocks were produced for a game of badminton. Count Wilhelm tried to get Princess Sophie to join him, but she refused. Words were exchanged and she walked away in a huff. Two ladies in waiting and one of the gentlemen made up the foursome instead. The young grandsons played games of tag, shrieking like normal children everywhere. Little Princess Ina, trying to be more stately and ladylike, went picking flowers. It was really the first time I'd had a chance to see the royal family acting like any normal family.
"Look, Mama, I've made a bouquet for you."
Princess Ina came up to her mother, presenting her collection.
"Very nice, Liebchen," Princess Beatrice said, "but you should ask which flowers can be picked."
"I understand. Those pink ones are oleander and very poisonous. Throw them away and ask Nanny to wash your hands."
"Yes, Mama."
The little girl looked crestfallen and worried. I turned to Mr. Phelps. "If we have nothing more to do, I'm going for a walk," I said, wishing to distance myself from the Prince of Wales as soon as possible. "I've been wanting to take a look at that monastery." And off I went into the park. I paused to watch the children's carousel, then headed towards the monastery that loomed over the far side of the lawns. I ascended a flight of steps and found a little churchyard to one side. It was so different from the Highgate Cemetery where my parents were buried. Tall marble mausoleums so close together it was like a small city. As I wandered between them, I heard the sound of crying. I came around a corner, and there was Princess Sophie, leaning against a tomb, sobbing softly. Forgetting my place, I went up to her.
"What's wrong?" I asked. "Is there anything I can do to help?"
She looked at me, not knowing who I was.
"You are part of the Queen's household," she asked in her strong German accent. "I am, Mum, one of her cooks.
I know it's not my place to speak to you, but I hated to see you in such distress." She gave a little shrug.
"There is nothing you can do," she said. "I am to be married to a monster, a man I can never love."
"Surely you do not have to marry against your wishes." She gave me a pitying look.
"You do not understand how it is for us. Marriage is not for love. It is for power, for political motivation. My father and the Queen feel that Wilhelm's state is too closely linked with the Austrian Emperor and that he is too friendly with the German Kaiser."
"But the German Kaiser is her relative, surely?" I said. She shrugged.
"Wilhelm has ambitions of his own. A new German Empire, you know. Quite dangerous. They would like to lure him into the Queen's fold. Therefore, I must marry him, and he will become one of us. That is how it works."
"I'm really sorry for you," I said, "but if you refuse, can they force you?"
"Would you dare to refuse and go against your father and the Queen's wishes?" she asked. "You must know how terrifying she can be."
"I would remind her how much she loved Prince Albert and tell her that you feel that you cannot love the Count."
"I did try something of the kind, and she said that love comes with time, and I am so young and must be patient."
Then she shook her head, making her curls dance.
"But Albert was a good, kind man, from what I have heard. Wilhelm is a bully, selfish, rude, critical. He will dominate my life." She leaned closer to me. "But it's worse than that. Do you know what he said to me? He said that once I have given him an heir, he will not bother me again."
"I am very sorry for you, Mum." She gave a sad little laugh.
"I suppose I should be thankful that he will not bother me, but I want a man to love me. I want to be held in his arms and feel safe. Is that too much to wish for?"
"No, not at all. Is your mother still alive? I'm sure she would understand your feelings." She shook her head.
"She died when I was only 5. My father had a string of mistresses. I've hated them all. Common, vulgar women. I have been to stay with Cousin Victoria many times, and I have enjoyed being at the palace until now. But she will not budge on my marrying Wilhelm. I am doomed to a loveless life ahead of me."
Then she seemed to realize that she was speaking with a servant and had said too much.
"You will not repeat a word of what I have told you."
I reverted to a subservient mode.
"Of course not, Mum. You can rely on me. I should return to the Queen. It was rude of me to wander off. They will come looking for me."
"You can tell them you are fascinated with old tombstones," I said, "or that cemeteries remind you of your dear mother." And she actually laughed.
"You are a devious and wise person," she said. "I wish you were closer to my station in life. I think we could have been friends. I am sorely in need of a friendship right now."
"I am available any time you wish to talk, Your Highness," I replied.
"I don't think the ladies would understand."
I gave her a little curtsy and let her go ahead of me, back to the picnic. I lingered up at the monastery, watching the princess walk back through the trees and across the park. Then I made my own way back and found the party still sitting and talking. Mr. Phelps had disappeared, so I headed back to the hotel, pausing to go into the Roman ruins. They were quite impressive, a large amphitheatre with arches still intact with spring flowers growing from cracks in the masonry. I was lost in contemplation until a gust of wind brought me back to the present and made me realize I should return to my duties. There was dinner to think about. As I approached the archway, a figure stopped out of the shadows.
"There you are, you little minx," said the Prince of Wales.
I swallowed back a small gasp. He was a large man, and he was blocking my escape. He put a finger under my chin and stepped closer, too close.
"You have been a bad girl," he said. "You did not come to visit your brother. I was most put out. I only gave him the job because of you, you know."
"I'm sorry, sir," I said. "It is not easy to get time off when one works in a royal kitchen."
"I shall make sure my mother is invited to dine with relatives frequently while she is here," he said. "Then you will have no excuse when I send a carriage for you."
"I'm sure you have very fine chefs of your own, sir," I replied, deliberately misunderstanding. He laughed at this. He had a big, hearty laugh.
"You know very well it is not your cooking I am interested in. You fascinate me. I've always had a penchant for redheads, and you have this air of purity that I find quite seductive."
The finger was still beneath my chin. He pulled me closer to him and planted those big lips on mine. His beard was prickly and his lips were moist. It was all I could do not to slap him or push him away. That one hand held my neck while the other started to explore my body. I was beyond shocked as his hand lingered over my breast. As soon as he broke away, I put my hands on my chest and tried to push.
"Please, sir, I beg of you, I am an innocent girl and wish to stay that way until I marry."
He was looking at me with amusement in his eyes, rather relishing my panic, I thought.
"Oh, the blushing virgin, how delightful, how irresistible. Now you really have whetted my appetite."
"I can't understand your interest in me," I said. "You can have any woman in the world. Sarah Bernhardt is staying at our hotel."
"She was amusing for a while, I'll grant you. But it is such a chore having to speak French all the time. You know, I can ask Mama to lend me her cook."
"In which case, I shall go to her and ask her to refuse your request," I said. After the initial shock, my fighting spirit was returning. "I know that your mother does not approve of your behavior. She would not want me to be forced into a situation where I would be so compromised."
He was looking at me with interest now, as if he was seeing me as a person for the first time.
"You're an eloquent young thing," he said. "Educated. How did you become a cook?"
"I was orphaned and had no family to take me in," I said.
"I went into service to support my young sister."
"Commendable. A martyr as well as a virgin."
"Please do not mock me, sir," I said. "You can't imagine how abhorrent it was for me to find myself as a servant. Through my cooking skills, at least I've been able to rise a little."
He stroked my cheek.
"You silly girl, don't you see what I am offering you? I'm offering what you have been looking for, a way out of servitude. I'll set you up with a nice little villa here if you like. I'll come and visit when I'm on the Riviera. The rest of the year you do what you like. Find any man who tickles your fancy. Even marry him. I don't mind. I'm generous. I'm willing to share. And when we tire of each other, why, the villa is still yours to keep. What could be fairer than that?"
What could indeed? The thought did flash through my mind. Why was I being so noble and prudish when I had no honour? I was a servant girl, after all. King Leopold of the Belgians had bought his mistress a villa. I would indeed never have to work for my living again. Except that the thought of that man touching me, holding me, forcing himself on me was more than I could bear.
"I'm really sorry, sir," I said quietly, "but I prefer to wait for a man that I can love."
"I'm sure you'd come to love me," he said. "I'm a lovable sort of chap. Ask any of my mistresses. They'll tell you how well I treat them."
"I'm sure you are a very nice man," I said, "but that's not the sort of life I want for myself."
His gaze turned suspicious.
"You're not one of those women, are you? You know, a damned sapphist."
I didn't know. He chuckled.
You really are a little innocent, aren't you? Women who like other women.
Oh, no. I blushed with shock at such a suggestion. I hadn't even known such people. I want to have a husband and family one day, when I meet the right man. But until then, you are turning down the heir to the throne of the most powerful country in the world. I have to say I admire your integrity, young woman. I find you damned infuriating, but I respect your decision. Never let it be said that I have forced myself on a woman. He stepped back from me. Well, I'd better let you get back to your kitchen pots and pans, hadn't I?
Thank you, sir. He must have heard the relief in my voice. I'm not really that repulsive to you, am I?
Not at all, sir. I lied. I think you are a handsome man, but...
Not the man for you, eh?
I nodded gratefully.
Go on, then. Off you go.
He slapped my behind and shoved me ahead of him through the archway. I don't think I breathed again until I was safely inside the hotel. I went up to my room, splashed cold water onto my face, and rinsed out my mouth.
Chapter 26. The day of the carnival procession dawned bright and clear. This was good news, as apparently the year before there had been constant rain during the pre-Lenten days and the parade had to be cancelled. We cooks all made our way down to the town together at twilight. Mr. Williams and Mr. Phelps gave the impression that they really didn't want to attend such a foreign and pagan event, but felt they should to remind themselves how civilized we were in England. But they seemed to warm to the prospect as we neared the centre of town and passed booths selling all kinds of flags, trinkets and foods.
"A genuine Italian gelato," Mr. Angelo exclaimed. "I haven't had one of those since I was a boy. Of course, we are only a few miles from Italy here, aren't we? Do you fancy one, Mr. Phelps?"
"I think I might," Mr. Phelps agreed, looking at the mounds of brightly coloured ice cream.
Mr. Williams and Jimmy both thought they'd like to try one too, but the temperature had dropped and I was already feeling a little chilly, so I declined, regretting it later as I watched their expressions of ecstasy. The Place Massena, that big square with adjoining gardens leading down to the seafront, was brightly lit with flares and torches as well as the usual gas lamps and already packed with people. The crowd was a delightful melange of peasants in their bright striped skirts and shawls mingling with loud drunken working men plus well-dressed families. There were also many people wearing outlandish costumes, pierrots and pirates and red Indians. Stands had been erected for those who wished to pay for a better view, and there was a special one of these right at the front of the parade route, reserved for the Queen and her party.
"The Queen likes to be a part of things," Mr. Angelo muttered. "They throw flowers from some of the floats. She likes to collect the flowers and throw them back at handsome young men."
We were smiling at this as we tried to find a spot where we would have a good view of the procession. Eventually, we forced our way through the crowd and took up our places, packed in like sardines. The large woman standing next to me smelled strongly of garlic and unwashed body. As darkness fell, the Queen and her party arrived. There was polite clapping as she was half escorted, half lifted to her viewing platform. The rest of the royal party took up their positions around her. I was interested to see that they were sitting on ordinary hard benches like the rest of the stands, although a couple of cushions were provided for the Queen to raise her high enough to see. I noticed that the Indian Munshi was not being allowed on the seats near her. Count Wilhelm was blocking him, perched at the end of the narrow wooden bench. It certainly wasn't the sort of accommodation that the Queen was used to, but she didn't seem to mind. I could see her face, and she seemed as excited as a young girl, waving to people and pointing things out to her grandchildren. There was no sign of her Highland guards. Tonight, she really was just Lady Balmoral, enjoying herself like everyone else. No sooner were they settled than we heard the sound of a brass band in the distance. Shouts and cheers greeted the band, looking impressive in their bright uniforms, adorned with lots of braid.
Behind them came the first of the floats. I don't know what I expected, but it was enormous. A hideous caricature head of a man, some 20 feet high, on top of a cart dragged by a team of men. His mouth was open, and legs were protruding from it as if he was eating people. It was quite terrifying. "Guermont," the woman next to me said, grinning and giving me a dig in the ribs. Then a young man on the other side of me explained. The floats were often political comments. Guermont was a politician who was intent on making money at the expense of the little people. More floats followed, a giant crocodile, more enormous heads, floats decorated with flowers, more bands, and beside them men on stilts, clowns, tumblers, dancers in scanty costumes. "I bet she's chilly," Mr. Williams commented as a young woman wearing nothing more than feathers passed us. The crowd around us cheered, jeered, shouted, and drank wine straight from the bottle, passing it around between them. The parade seemed to go on forever. I was growing tired of standing, of being shoved, and of being enveloped in the garlic odour of my large neighbour. Suddenly, a loud popping noise was heard over the raucous din of the crowd. "Fireworks," Mr. Angelo said. "There are always fireworks after the parade." But then there were screams. Someone else was shouting. "The Queen! They've shot the Queen!" Chaos ensued. I tried to see what was happening, but the crowd panicked, pushing this way and that, trying to flee from gunfire, wanting to gain distance from the royal stand. I tried to free myself and get to the Queen, but I was borne forward in the crush of people. It was surreal. "The Queen's been shot." The words were screaming inside my brain. I must see if I can help. But at this moment, my main worry was that I would trip and be trampled. When at last the momentum of the crowd slowed, I was no longer on the Place Masséna, but in a dark and narrow side street. I had no idea where I was. People were still streaming past me, and I caught snatches of conversation. "Anarchists! They shot the Queen of England!" I wanted to make my way back. I looked around me, but there was no sign of the other cooks, no sign of anyone I knew, and I wasn't even sure which way we had come. The crowd was making it impossible for me to retrace my steps. All I could do was to wait in a doorway until they had dispersed. Then a group of rowdy men approached, singing loudly. I shrank into the doorway, but they had spotted me.
"Hello, chérie," one of them said, looming up over me. "All alone, ma petite." "Oh, that's too bad. You need company. You come with us. We'll give you a good time."
His speech was slurred. He was grinning like an idiot. They pressed around me. One of them took my arm.
"Allons," he called out. "Let's go."
"No, leave me alone. I don't want..." My French was failing me in a moment of panic.
"But we are such nice boys." Another one stuck his face in front of mine. "You will like us, I promise you."
I didn't know what to do. There were five of them. The rest of the crowd streamed past as if we didn't exist. They were now propelling me along with them. "Leave me. I do not wish..." I struggled to free myself.
"Ah, Colette, ma petite, there you are."
A man's voice boomed as a figure emerged from the darkness.
"Take your hands off my little sister immediately. I have a knife and I can assure you I am very good with it." "We were looking after her for you, my friend," one of the captors said, releasing my arm. "A woman should not be alone in a crowd like this. No offense." "You should not have wandered off alone, little sister," the newcomer said, addressing me now. He grabbed my sleeve roughly. "Come, we go home now."
I couldn't think what to do next. This really was a case of out of the frying pan and into the fire. Clearly, I must resemble this man's sister in the darkness. If I said I was not his sister, then I had no idea what might happen. He could release me back to the drunks, and he had a knife. He took my hand and dragged me forward.
"Don't struggle. Come quickly with me now," he said,
and finally I recognized the voice. In the darkness, I could make out his face. Jean-Paul Le Pen. and his hand was grasping mine. Together we hurried away out of the main stream of the crowd and into a quiet backwater of a residential square. "I have to stop. I can't breathe," I said at last. We had been going at a great pace. He stopped.
"That was a foolish thing you were doing, alone on a night like this," he said, glaring at me. "You were lucky I came along."
"I wasn't alone," I said. "I was with the other cooks. There were gunshots and somebody screaming, and they were saying the Queen had been shot. Then everyone started running, and I was forced along with them, and suddenly I didn't know where I was, and those men came." The words came out in a great rush. I'm not sure whether my French was grammatically correct or even understandable. Without warning, a great hiccup of a sob came out of my mouth. "And if you hadn't come and saved me, I..." And I started to cry. Immediately his arms came around me and he was holding me close to him.
"It's all right, ma petite. You are safe now. You are with me. All is well."
"But the Queen. They shot the Queen."
Tears cascaded down my cheeks. Jean-Paul stroked my hair. "Don't cry. I don't think she was struck."
"Are you sure?"
"No, but from what people were saying, the bullets missed her."
I looked up at him. His eyes were sparkling in the light of a street lamp. Then suddenly, he was kissing me. And to my amazement, I was responding to his kiss, my body pressed against his, feeling his heart beating against mine. When we broke apart, gasping, he was smiling down at me.
"Listen, chérie, we do not have to go back immediately. My cousin has a little hotel nearby. Why don't we go there for a while?"
"Why would I need a hotel when we can make our way back to Simier now that the crisis has passed?" I asked. He chuckled, as if I had said something amusing.
"But you have had a shock. Would you not like a place to recover with a cognac, perhaps? And you and I, we could get to know each other better, away from the Regina."
All I could hear in my head was the Prince of Wales saying, "We could get to know each other better," and those awful men grabbing at me. I took a step back. "No," I exclaimed. "You have formed the wrong impression of me, monsieur." He looked puzzled.
"Forgive me if I misunderstood," he said. "I had no wish to insult you, but you certainly did not repulse my kisses. In fact, I got the impression that you would like to spend time alone with me."
My cheeks were flaming with embarrassment. I was carried away. The fear, the chaos. I didn't know what I was doing.
"Oh, I think you knew, and you were doing it very well, too." He couldn't resist a grin.
I heard my voice, high and cold.
"I am shocked that you would think I am the sort of girl who would dream of going to a hotel with a man she hardly knows. I was raised in a good family, or is it just because I am a servant now that I am seen to be easy pickings?"
He took a step away from me.
"But, mademoiselle, you misunderstand me. I had no wish to..."
"Of course you had a wish. You are like all men. You prey on us, innocent females."
"I apologize, mademoiselle," he said stiffly. "I assure you, I will keep my distance in the future."
"I must get back to the Regina," I said. "The Queen. The Queen may need me."
"The Queen needs you? And why might that be?" he demanded. "I think if she needs anyone, it would be her doctor, not a sous chef."
The words felt like a slap in the face. "Thank you for saving me, monsieur," I said coldly. "If you would just direct me to the quickest route up the hill."
"I will escort you."
"There is no need," I said. "I am sure you do not wish to waste your time with a mere sous chef."
"Nevertheless, I will not let you wander about alone tonight. I know my duty as an honest Frenchman," he said. "Come, this way."
He took my arm and marched me off at a great pace. We did not speak a word as we went up the hill. I was out of breath and terrified that I might cry at any moment. When we reached the forecourt of the hotel, Jean-Paul gave me a curt little bow.
"You will be safe now," he said, and stalked off into the night.
Chapter 27. I stood in the darkness, trying to catch my breath and compose myself before I made my way to the hotel. The forecourt was bustling with activity. Lights were streaming out, illuminating two police wagons standing outside with what I presumed to be French policemen beside them. There were newspaper reporters and a curious crowd comprised of hotel guests as well as local citizens who must have followed the royal procession up from the town. I looked around for the Queen's carriage, wondering if she had been taken to a hospital instead of coming here, but to my relief, I saw it being led around to the stables. I was dying of curiosity and worry by this time and searched for a familiar face. Off to one side, several of Her Majesty's footmen were standing. I made my way over to them. "Is there any news? Is Her Majesty all right?" I asked.
"Lucky, that's what she is," one of them said. "This must be the fourth or fifth attempt on her life, and every time they miss." "They didn't exactly miss this time," the other said. "She might have been killed if that German count hadn't pushed her to one side to shield her and taken the bullet himself."
To hear that Count Willy had been a hero was remarkable news indeed. "Count Wilhelm was shot. Is he dead?"
"Nah, the bullet just grazed his shoulder. The shooter wasn't much of a marksman, if you ask me. One of these fanatical students who want to change the world order."
"Is that who it was? A student?"
"They haven't caught him yet," the first man said, "and I doubt they will. With a crowd that size, nobody saw anything until there were gunshots, and then there was a right panic, wasn't there? Everyone running and screaming. Weren't you there?"
"Yes, I was, but I got swept away with the crowd."
"You're lucky you weren't trampled. Quite a few people were, weren't they, Tom?" The other nodded. "These foreigners, you know, too excitable. That would never have happened in London."
I bade them good night and went up to bed. It was only when I was alone in my room that the emotion of the evening overcame me. I had a good cry and realized something. Since the day I had become a servant, I had never allowed myself to cry once. It had been a matter of pride that whatever was thrown at me, it could not break me. Now it was as if something had snapped and I had finally allowed myself to have feelings. And with that came the realization that I had felt something for Jean-Paul Le Pen, and I had driven him away. When I came to breakfast the next morning, there was no sign of my fellow cooks. Henri and several other French chefs were already working away in their part of the kitchen. Jean-Paul was not amongst them. "Have my compatriots already eaten breakfast or not yet arisen?" I asked Henri.
"I have not seen them today, mademoiselle," Henri replied. "Perhaps they overslept after too much merrymaking last night. Did you go to the carnival procession?"
"I did," I replied.
"Your queen had a lucky escape, so I hear."
"Yes, so I heard. You didn't go yourself?" He shook his head.
"I've seen it all before. Too many people for my liking. Too much wine drunk."
"Has Chef Le Pen gone to the market?" I asked, trying to keep my tone casual.
"Yes, he left early. I told him we had enough supplies because nobody ate at the hotel last night, but he wouldn't listen. He was in a bad mood for some reason. Maybe he consumed too much wine last night."
I left him to his preparations and helped myself to bread, jam, and coffee. Still, there was no sign of Mr. Angelo and the others. I was beginning to feel annoyed. If they didn't show up soon, then the Queen's breakfast would be left to me. I was just leaving the table when Dr. Reed came into the kitchen.
"You are Miss Barton?" he said in his soft Scottish accent.
"Yes, Doctor. Can I help you? Does the royal party require something different for breakfast after last night's shock?"
"I understand that the Queen wants no breakfast today. The incident has really upset her. She doesn't feel like eating, which is unusual for her, and she will remain in her bedchamber. Count Wilhelm wants his breakfast to be taken up to him on a tray as soon as possible. A good nourishing breakfast was how he put it."
"How is the Count? Was his wound severe?"
"No, merely a graze. He will make a full recovery soon."
"But this was not what I came to see you about.
Your fellow cooks, apparently they ate Italian ices from a stall last night.
Yes, they did. I chose not to because I was already feeling cold.
Then I'd say you had a lucky escape, just like the Queen.
I paused, digesting this. Are they ill?
Very ill, he said. I hope it is only food poisoning, but I suspect dysentery from bad water, and I just pray it is not typhoid or worse.
Worse? What could be worse than typhoid?
Cholera. We now know that it comes from contaminated water. I don't know what they were thinking, eating ices from a street stall in a strange city. The water probably came straight from the river, which also serves as the town's sewer.
This is terrible news, I said.
I agree. You'll have more work than you can handle.
I wasn't thinking of that. I was worried about my colleagues. Typhoid? Cholera? It might spread through the whole hotel.
I'm taking precautions and keeping them isolated. If they can keep down fluids, they will come through, although at the moment I can't guarantee anything. Naturally, I'll do my best for them. I suggest you boil some rice with cinnamon in it, and we'll give them the rice water to drink. That is settling to the stomach, and later some beef tea.
Very good, Doctor, I said.
And I will have a word with the Queen's secretary. I'll ask him to requisition a couple of French cooks to help you. He paused. There is no way a young girl like yourself should be left to face this amount of responsibility alone. But you seem level-headed and capable. I expect we'll all get through it, one way or another.
With those comforting words, he gave me a little pat on the shoulder and left me. I stood like a statue trying to digest all this. My fellow cooks were so sick they might die. They might have brought cholera or typhoid to the hotel and put the Queen and her party in danger, and I had scarcely considered my role now. I was the sole cook left to cater for a party of royal persons and their retinue. Well, there was nothing for it but to get going, I decided. They'd have to make do with simple meals and few choices until I had help. I got to work, putting on the rice and cinnamon to cook, then sent in an order for beef bones and calves' feet for our invalids. I cooked scrambled eggs and bacon to be sent up to the royal dining room and managed a kedgeree and more bacon for the ladies and gentlemen of the household. I piled both onto a plate for the injured Count Willie and sent it up with a footman. I was just wondering what Mr. Angelo had in mind for luncheon when I looked up to see Jean-Paul approaching me.
Your royal doctor has informed me of the distressing news, he said in a most formal voice. I am most sorry for your colleagues. I have told your doctor that I will put two of my reliable chefs at your disposal. I suggested that they take care of all the meals for the household while you confine yourself, just to Her Majesty and her royal relatives, knowing your great devotion to your queen.
Thank you, you are most kind, I replied. Your consideration is much appreciated. Even as I spoke the words, I could sense the sting in the tail of his own speech. My great devotion to my queen, indeed. He was mocking me for last night, but at least he was making my task bearable. Maybe he genuinely was trying to help me out. I decided on a simple poached fish dish and saffron chicken over rice for the royal luncheon, as we had cold chicken from the previous day. As accompaniments, the creamed celery, of which they were so fond, and a mushroom soup. There was sponge cake left from the previous day's tea. I soaked it in sherry and made a quick trifle. It might be nursery food, but I'd never found anyone who didn't like a good trifle, especially if one added enough cream. Once that was all under control, I went to find one of the ladies in waiting and asked about the Queen. Could I not prepare her something to eat?
She says she wants nothing, Lady Lytton said. She is still in distress. It is useless trying to talk to her when she is in one of her stubborn moods. I rather suspect she is determined to make us all see how upset she is over this latest affront. I went back to my kitchen. I didn't like to think that the Queen was refusing to eat. That was a bad sign at her age. It meant she was giving up on life. And if there was a deadly disease like typhoid in the hotel, she'd be more susceptible if she was in a weakened state.
my latest encounter with Ronnie Barton flashed into my mind. His outrageous suggestion that I cook items that would make the Queen weak, and therefore a simple grip might finish her off. Suddenly I remembered times in my own childhood when I had been ill in bed. My mother had taken care of me and fed me tempting little morsels. I had an idea. I set to work and then carried out the tray myself to the Queen's bedroom. The dreaded Indian Munshi was standing on guard outside her door.
"What is this?" he snapped when he saw me approaching.
"It is for Her Majesty," I replied. "It is something to tempt her to eat and regain her strength. Will you take it in to her, please?"
"I have been instructed to leave her alone. She wants to see nobody and she needs to rest. So, go away." He waved at me as if I were an annoying fly.
"I would like her to eat this while it is still warm. If you care about your queen, you will want her to make a speedy recovery, which she will not do if she refuses to eat." I took a deep breath because he was quite a big man and he was blocking my path. "If you will not take it to her, then I will."
"You will not enter Her Majesty's presence," he said angrily. "You, a common servant."
"As you are," I replied. "I know all about you, Mr. Karim. I know you did not come from an educated family. You were sent as a table servant, which is several levels below a cook. Now step aside, or I shall have to find Sir Arthur and Dr. Reed to assist me."
"Upon your own head be it, stupid girl," he said, looking daggers at me.
I tapped gingerly on the door, then opened it and stepped into the Queen's bedchamber. It was not a large room and rather overly furnished, with the bed she had brought out from England, as well as a large wardrobe and several chests of drawers. And being on the first floor, it did not have the commanding view over the bay that my windows did. The Queen was lying back, looking like a small doll against all those lace pillows.
"Your Majesty," I said softly.
She opened her eyes.
"What do you want?" she asked.
"I said I was to be left alone."
"Forgive my presumption," I said, coming closer. "But when you have had a shock, you should be reviving your system. I've brought you hot, sweet tea, which is supposed to be the best thing for shock. And I've made you what my mother used to make me when I was sick as a child. It's a boiled egg with soldiers."
"Soldiers?" she demanded, sitting up now.
I put the tray down in front of her. "That's what my mother always called the thin fingers of toast, because they stand up so straight."
"Soldiers," she gave a little smile.
"It's been a long time since I've had a plain boiled egg."
"Please try a little," I said. She took a sip of tea.
"This is not a China tea," she said.
"No, it's an ordinary British tea, but it's strong, and that's what you need right now." She looked up at me.
"You're a rather forceful young woman, aren't you?"
"Not usually, ma'am. It's just that I was so concerned about you. And when they said you wanted to be left alone and not eat, I was worried that you might have given up on life and that you would just slip away." She looked at me and laughed.
"Can you see me just slipping away? My dear young woman, I was born to duty, and I do not intend to relinquish my role as Empress and ruler of our great empire until the day that God calls me home, which I hope will be many years from now. Besides, I have a jubilee to celebrate this year."
"I'm very glad to hear it, ma'am," I noted with satisfaction that she had taken a finger of toast and was dipping it into her egg.
"To tell you the truth," she said after she had taken a bite, "I was tired of all the fussing over me. My daughters were screaming and fainting and behaving like hysterical females. I just wanted to be left alone to think. It makes one pause when one faces one's own mortality. It's not the first time I've been shot at, you know."
"I heard, ma'am," I said. "There have been several attempts on your life."
"All of them terrible marksmen, fortunately," the Queen said with a small grin of satisfaction. "But I have to confess, this time it did rattle me more than I thought it would. In the past,
I had my dear Albert to comfort and protect me," she sighed. "I still miss him after all this time. It's a wound that will never heal until I am joined with him again. I understand that Count Wilhelm saved your life," I said. She gave a derisive snort. "More by luck than heroism, I suspect. I think he was trying to get out of the way and accidentally pushed me aside. But we shall let the world think of him as the hero, shall we not?" I wondered if I should dare say anything about Princess Sophie, then did not have the courage to do so. She ate more bites of her breakfast, and to my delight, she finished her boiled egg. "This was an excellent suggestion," she said. "Were you instructed to prepare it for me, or did you do it of your own initiative?" "I am alone in the kitchen at the moment, ma'am. The other cooks all ate Italian ices at the carnival and have come down with stomach complaints." I thought it wise not to mention that these complaints might be of a serious nature at this moment. I'd leave Dr. Reed to impart that news. "You certainly can't handle an entire kitchen alone," she looked at me with concern. "I have two of the hotel chefs seconded to me, and I will be handling just your personal meals until the men recover. So if there are any particular dishes you would like, please have your table servant let me know." "I did like those mushrooms the other day. Very tasty." "Very well, ma'am. I shall go to the market tomorrow and bring back a selection for you," I said. She was frowning at me now. "You seem to be a young woman of good family," she said. "How is it that you became a cook? Was this an ambition of yours?" "Not originally, ma'am. I was orphaned as a young girl, alone in the world, and had to provide for my sister, so domestic service was my only option. Later, I developed an interest in cooking and found that I had a certain amount of talent for it."
"You had no extended family to take you in after your parents died?"
"I'm afraid my father was estranged from his family, and my mother had no close relatives." I realised as I spoke that I was giving details of Bella Waverley's family, not Helen Barton's. Should I have invented a cottage in Yorkshire instead? Except that it was impossible to lie to the Queen.
"You poor child," she said. "But I trust you are happy in your current situation."
"I couldn't be happier, Your Majesty," I said. "The chance to prepare fine foods and exotic dishes is the dream of every cook. And to be cooking for you, well, that is the proverbial icing on the cake." She actually patted my hand.
"Then I hope you shall stay with us for a long time, although I shall put some thought to finding you a suitable husband. I cannot think it would be the right thing for you to marry at your current level in life."
"I'm in no hurry to marry, ma'am," I said.
"Nevertheless, a young woman is not fulfilled until she has a husband and children. I was not thrilled to be a mother to begin with. I found my babies tiresome. But look what I have now achieved. I have placed my progeny in all the great royal houses of Europe. If there were ever a conflict, I can call upon allies from many powerful nations. Although I have to admit my grandson in Germany seems to have big ideas and is not showing the amount of respect one would expect for his grandmother, the Empress." She paused, considering this, and presumably whether it was right for her to impart such thoughts to a lowly servant, but then she went on. "Which is one of the reasons I have invited Count Wilhelm into the fold. He seems to be a devoted lapdog of the Kaiser. So the marriage to my young cousin is fortuitous at this moment." "I understand that Her Highness Princess Sophie is not happy about the marriage," I said. She looked surprised that I should have dared to mention this. "And how do you know of these things? Does Sophie frequent the kitchen?"
"Oh, no, ma'am. I came upon her crying one day when we were in the park. She was most distressed. I tried to comfort her."
"Sophie tends to be rather dramatic and too emotional, I'm afraid. Bad blood on her mother's side. and she has been raised to be a rather spoiled young woman, used to getting her own way. I can see that she is resisting marriage to a man who will clearly wish to dominate her. But alas, she will have to learn to compromise. Maybe she can even learn to tame her husband. But if she doesn't love him... Love? The Queen shook her head. I'm afraid that love does not often enter into royal marriage arrangements. They are solely for political reasons, and every royal person knows and accepts this. Sophie will learn to accept her destiny as we all have. She paused, and a little smile crossed her lips. I was one of the lucky ones. I was able to select my own spouse, and I married a man I could love with all my heart. She pointed to the tray. You may take this now. It was a thoughtful gesture on your part, and I much appreciated it. I shall take my luncheon up here, but this afternoon, if the weather remains fine, I may take a turn in the garden. You shall bring me my tray and talk to me again. At my age, I appreciate a fresh young face. Yes, ma'am, I said. I took the tray, curtsied, and backed out of the room, only once bumping into the corner of a large dresser. The Munshi was hovering outside. You were there a long time, he said. Yes, we had a lovely chat, I replied. She will be taking her luncheon in her chamber, but after that she may want to be pushed around the gardens. I gave him a triumphant smile as I walked away. Chapter 28. It was only when I was back in the safety of the kitchen that I realized what I had done. If the Queen wanted to chat with me again, she might well ask me questions about my family, my childhood, and I would presumably have to lie. All I knew about Yorkshire I had gleaned from reading Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights, bleak moors where the wind whistled through chimneys, and I'd have to explain why my folks had chosen to live there and why I had no Yorkshire accent. Either that or come clean. Would the Queen understand and appreciate why I took this one chance, or would she see it as trickery, sending me packing straight back to England? It was a risk I couldn't take. I poached a fillet of sole for her with a parsley sauce, then added a bowl of mushroom soup, a bunch of grapes, and a small dish of trifle. When I presented it to her, she stared at it for a moment. You obviously think I'm back in the nursery, she said. Next it will be bread and milk, or gruel. Oh, no, ma'am, I replied, flushing with embarrassment. I was merely thinking that when one doesn't feel like eating, one needs food that just slips down without much effort. You are a thoughtful young woman, she said, and you may be right. You may leave me now. I don't wish to be observed slurping my soup. I'll ring for a servant when I am finished. And for tonight, ma'am? A lamb cutlet? A little chicken? She looked up at me, her eyes remarkably young and twinkling. No, I think I have languished long enough. I shall be eating with the family tonight in the dining room, and I rather fancy duck. I smiled. This is good news. I'll see to it, ma'am. She returned my smile. And you won't forget about my mushrooms tomorrow, will you? Of course not, ma'am. I'll go to the market first thing. As I backed away, she said, Don't work too hard. We shall understand if the fare is less elaborate than usual. I realized from my boiled egg this morning that sometimes we appreciate the taste of simple things rather than when good ingredients are disguised under myriad sauces. Absolutely right, ma'am. If the ingredients themselves are top quality, they should speak for themselves. I curtsied, and as I opened the door, I saw the Munshi hovering right outside. Is Her Majesty recovering? Does she need me to assist her with her papers? He asked. Your Indian servant is here, ma'am, I said. Do you wish him to come in? Absolutely not,
she said. "I've already told him that. It is not proper that any man observe the Queen in her night attire, and certainly not a man whose religion covers up their own women and keeps them locked away in harems. Tell him I will summon him when I am ready to go out later."
How I wished I could say something to her. Let her know how anxious her household members were about this man and his ties to dangerous Indian agitators. But a cook does not advise a queen. I closed the door and turned to the Indian. "She says it is not proper that you should attend while she is in bed, and it is not acceptable that you should want to see any official papers." I added the last part myself. I went back to the kitchen and started to think about dinner preparations. I had never cooked a duck in my life. I flicked through our cookery books. There were hundreds of ways to cook a duck, but also warnings that ducks were very fatty and that the skin was not appetizing and less crisp, but that the meat beneath the skin should not dry out. In the end, I had to swallow my pride and went over to Jean-Paul. "I am sorry to disturb you, chef," I said, "but the Queen has requested duck tonight, and I'm afraid we do not eat duck often in England. I wondered if you could recommend a dish for me to prepare." Those dark eyes studied me for a moment. "He's going to turn me down," I thought, "to make me fail." Then he said,
"I too have put duck on the menu tonight. Go and get two more birds from the meat safe, and you shall prepare it with me."
"I can't thank you enough," I said.
"It is my duty to assist new cooks," he said stiffly, "especially visiting cooks from abroad."
I fetched the ducks, already dressed and ready, thankfully. I was not very good at taking off heads and feet.
"A simple roast duck with an orange sauce might be a good way to start," he said. "The secret is to prick the skin in 1,000 places. Place it in a moderate oven for 1 hour, bring it out, let it stand for the fat to run off, then baste it, put it back in a hot oven to crisp the skin."
"Is this how you are serving it tonight?"
"No, that would be an insult to my talent," he said. "I serve the traditional magret de canard, the breast of the duck cooked in its own fat until the skin is crisp, and then I shall serve it with figs and balsamic vinegar and local honey."
"And you do not think I am capable of this dish?" I demanded angrily.
"I wish to save you from too much work," he replied. "It is not easy the first time one has to run a kitchen alone."
"You're right," I admitted. "I will stick to the roast bird tonight, and perhaps later you will show me the secrets of the duck breast."
"Maybe," he said.
I wondered what I might serve to accompany the duck, something that would not require too much preparation or finesse. Then I decided that I would treat the royal party to a bouillabaisse, that rich seafood soup of the region. I'd even risk putting garlic in it. Jean-Paul noted the smell of what I was cooking.
"Ah, so now you have decided that our local food is worth eating," he commented.
"I'm trying to keep the menu simple so that there is not a lot of last-minute preparation," I said. "I've made chocolate pot de creme for their dessert." Even though the dishes were not complicated, I found I was quite tired and decided that I needed fresh air. I had been working since dawn. I took off my cap and apron and went out into the garden. It was a heavenly day, warm with the promise of spring. I stood beneath an umbrella pine tree, breathing in its scent until I heard voices and realized that Her Majesty's party was also in the gardens. How silly of me to have forgotten that she had said she wanted to take a turn outside. Their voices were coming towards me. The one thing we had had drummed into us as servants was that we should never be seen by our masters, and the last thing I wanted was for the Queen to talk to me in the presence of her family. She might ask more questions about my childhood. I shrank back behind the pine tree as the royal party approached, the Queen being pushed in a bath chair by the Munshi, her grandchildren at her sides, and Princess Beatrice following dutifully behind with the Queen's doctor and one of her ladies-in-waiting. The trunk of the pine tree was not broad enough to hide me if they came closer. I tried to retreat through a shrubbery of tall bushes, oleanders, gardenias, and camellias in full bloom. The scent of the blossoms was heady. As I pushed my way between bushes, there was a metallic clunking sound, and something dropped to the ground. I pulled a branch aside and peered down at the soil beneath. It was a gun. Trying not to get scratched or have my eye poked out, I bent to retrieve it, picking it up cautiously in case it was still loaded. Who might have dropped a gun in the bushes? I wondered. Then it dawned on me that the anarchist might have followed the Queen up here last night, wanting to finish off what he had attempted in the square. But perhaps there were too many people milling around. Perhaps someone had recognized him, causing him to throw the weapon deep into the bushes and flee. I should hand it over to the Queen's secretary, and it would be up to him to decide if it should be turned over to the French police. I wondered if they had recovered the bullet that struck the Count, and if so, whether the police could identify whether a bullet was fired from a certain gun. In any case, there was probably no way of tying a weapon to a certain person. Sir Arthur was not in the sitting room, and one of the gentlemen of the household said he had not seen him since luncheon. He had probably escaped for a snooze, the man said. I realized I was carrying a gun and hid my hand in the folds of my skirt. I hesitated, then decided this was important enough to wake him up if necessary. I had to tap on his door several times before a tousled head appeared, glaring at me.
"What do you want?" he demanded fiercely.
"I'm terribly sorry to disturb you, Sir Arthur," I said, "but I was walking in the garden and I found this gun. It had been thrown into the bushes. I wondered if it was the same weapon that shot at Her Majesty yesterday." I handed him the revolver and he stared down, examining it as it lay in his big hand. I watched his expression change.
"Could well be. The chap came up here to get another shot at her, but didn't get a chance, or was recognised and beat a hasty retreat. Thank you, my dear. You were wise to bring it to me. There is a Scotland Yard man on his way out to take charge of Her Majesty's security from now on. He'll know what to do."
"You don't think the French police should have it?" I asked cautiously. "After all, they are the ones who might know of anarchists in the region who might have had a plan to assassinate the Queen."
"We'll see what Inspector Raleigh decides to do. Personally, I fear the local police will be a bunch of bumbling idiots. That's just my prejudice against the French."
He gave a little chuckle and closed his door. As I started down the staircase, I could hear a woman's voice shrieking. Yes, shrieking was the only word for it.
"Where is it? You must..."